welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We're always interested in your thoughts. Drop us a note to indianaweekend@gmail.com with your suggestions and comments. Let us know what's going on where you are. Considering we're in a state named for the Indians and with so many place names that draw upon that history, it turns out there's a lot we don't know about the Native Americans and their history in Indiana. We get a few chances to sample that history. This is from the Andersontown Powwow, a celebration of Native American culture scheduled for September 10th and 11th in Anderson this year. Anderson, Delaware County, Muncie, Yorktown, just a few of the places that owe their names to tribes or Native American leaders. We might forget sometimes that Native Americans lived here for 2,000 years before Indiana became a state. So it's natural in this Hoosier bicentennial year to look at their history as well. A new book from Chris Fluke, Native Americans of East Central Indiana, should help fill in some of the gaps. The book is from History Press's American Heritage series. I talked with Chris in Muncie on a rainy morning recently on his screened-in back porch where he does most of his writing. He says the book is organized in two sections.
Well, I thought there was a pretty big hole in public knowledge for local history of Native Americans. So it's a history that goes back literally thousands of years. There's evidence of people living here thousands of years. So the first part of the book is really honestly not a history. It is an overview or a survey of sorts of the published archaeological knowledge of the native groups that lived in this area, with a focus on the Newcastle phase Native Americans, which were sort of an offshoot of the Edina and the Hopewell that lived here about 2,000 years ago. And then I cover a little bit about the post-contact Native Americans in the second half, with an emphasis on the Delaware or the Lenape, who lived here from basically the end of the Northwest Indian War until 1821.
They really weren't here all that long, right?
No, a very, very brief period of time. 1795, 1796, the land in this immediate area at that time was essentially vacant and had been a hunting area or territory of the Miami. If you've ever taken a canoe down the White River, you know that you spend more time out of the canoe pulling it through the sludge. You know, it's just not that much of a navigable river. So the Miami had used it as a hunting area, and so the Delaware were invited to live there. And then, you know, within 30 years, white settlement had encroached again into Indiana, and so they were pushed further west.
The Lenape had an experience and a history of being pushed back a lot.
Yeah, and there are some historians that suggest that they're probably the most oft-moved tribe. They're nowhere from here. They're from what we now call the Delaware and the Hudson Rivers out east along the Atlantic coast. And then over a 200, 300-year period, they just were pushed first into eastern Pennsylvania, then western Pennsylvania, then eastern Ohio, then Fort Wayne briefly, and then here, and then Missouri, then Kansas, and then Oklahoma, the main group that was here. But there are others that are spread all through the United States and Canada.
Where did the Delaware get their name?
The Delaware, their autonym, the name that they give themselves even today, they would refer to themselves as Lenape, which just means the people. And they lived in the Hudson River, what we now call the Hudson River area, Delaware River area. The second governor of Virginia had some weird British title. He was known as the Lord Delaware. And so the native groups in and around that area in northern Virginia, what we now call Delaware, New Jersey, were known as Delaware's Indians and just Delaware Indians. And then that name just stuck as they moved further west.
So the Lenape kept getting pushed back. In their tradition, did they talk about this? Did they commiserate about it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and when the Europeans first came, there was a Lenape people, but they were a decentralized ethnic group. There were God knows how many different villages. There was no titular chief. Each village had a sachem, or like a strong man of sorts, that sort of in a council. And the closest equivalent, I'm not even sure this is an exact analogy, would be like the Greek city-states in Hellenic Greece, you know. You had a Greek people, but you had the Spartans were the Spartans, and then the Athenians were the Athenians. And it's an approximate analogy that you had all these decentralized villages, and there was no one person that could speak. And as they got pushed west, they sort of formed centralized structure that the way that we sort of understand today.
They lived along the White River. I mean, Marion, Muncie, Anderson, yep. what today we call these places.
That's right. So there were as many as 14 village sites starting from just south of Muncie at the reservoir, going through Muncie into Yorktown, Anderson, all the way down to Connor's village, where Connor Prairie is now, and then a village called Bruay's Village, which was probably a trading village just inside the Marion County line. In Delaware County, there were four known village sites.
And Muncie got its name from...
That's right. So like one of the reasons I started researching on the book like 10 years ago was that there were... I had grown up embarrassingly thinking that there was a Chief Muncie. And there's not at all. There was
But that's probably what people here would
yes,
say, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Smart. And I'd like to think of myself as a smart person. It just, there was no Chief Muncie. And Muncie is a dialect, one of three main dialects that we know of the Lenape people. And they weren't really a sub-tribe, but because they spoke a different language, they sort of, when they were pushed west, they lived in sort of their own communities. And so the Muncie Lenape speakers lived in a village just north of the bend of the river, about the place where Minnetrista is now, and the five Ball Brother homes, or now four Ball Brother homes. And it was known by early settlers as the Muncie Village, and then it became
So they would have been kind of up on that bank, that's too, right. So they didn't get flooded out all the time.
Yeah, it's hard to see today because of the Army Corps of Engineers in the 20s or the 30s came through and has dug the levee system. But the river was on par, you know, or level with the rest of the Muncie, and it constantly flooded. So most of the Lenape villages are on bluffs or high points above the river, and even then it didn't always protect them.
And there were these different clans, right? So the name for animals.
Yeah, there were what they're referred to as fratries, and they're matrilineal. They're not really clans because there were subclans, but they're matrilineal groups, turkey, wolf, and turtle, that they used to organize what family you belong to. And it came through, it's very common for Algonquian speakers, it came through the female line. And it's basically just so you don't marry your cousin, you know, like just in the way that we'd sort of organize it today with the male names. And then each of those fratries had maybe like 12 clans. So that was one system that developed just basically for the descent group. And then they had the speakers, the Unami and the Muncie speakers, and they weren't the exact same system, but sort of as they were pushed inward, sort of developed this really dynamic sort of setup.
Talking with Chris Fluke, who teaches telecommunications at Ball State, about his new book, Native Americans of East Central Indiana. A book signing scheduled for Saturday, July 9th, from 8 a.m. to noon in the Orchard Shop at Minnetrista. You can buy the book there and at local bookstores.
Indiana Weekend. Interesting people and places from across our region. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line. Let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
The new book from Chris Fluke pulls together a lot of information about the Lenape, including their famous chief, Kekthewenand.
So Chief Anderson, William Anderson, he was half Lenape, and then his father, I think, was a Swedish ferry boat captain out east. And the city of Anderson is named after him. Muncie, obviously, is named after the Muncie speakers. Delaware County, Yorktown, which a lot of people think is is an homage to the Battle of Yorktown. There was, at the very end of the Lenape's time here, there was a group of Brotherton or Stockbridge Brotherton folks that were invited to come live with the Delaware, and they were from New York and referred to as York Indians. And when Oliver Smith platted the town, he named it Yorktown as an homage to the York Indians that were here. So lots of little communities all the way up and down the White River. Strawtown is named after the Straw King, which was the name of the chief that lived at the Delaware Strawtown. So
I'm trying to imagine, because when we're at Minnetrista, sometimes you stand kind of where the houses are, and you try and peer through the trees and look out there. And I think that there's a little diorama or something, a little model on the second floor of Minnetrista. You've done so much research and so much reading. Do you ever find yourself kind of imagining, let's see, if I close my eyes? I mean, because these weren't teepees that they
were
in.
No. They lived. I mean, and some of this stuff, a really great archaeologist about 10 years ago, she worked at Ball State, a woman by the name of Beth McCord, went out, I think, in 2005, 2006, and did some preliminary sort of digging in these village sites, these 14 village sites, and didn't really find anything. And because they were here a very brief period of time, and they lived essentially the same way that the white settlers did. So they built log cabins. They used guns the way the white settlers did. They wore a lot of the same clothing. Their utensils were. So anything that would have been found over the past 200 years looks like white folk stuff. And so it just was, even though it was Delaware, it just was sort of tossed aside or ignored. We do know that there were villages there because there are eyewitness accounts that people have written down. So Minas Turner, for example, was one of the early pioneers here. He was a brickmaker and other things. He recalls distinctly seeing the remnants of the Delaware village right at the bend of the river, and talks about the cemetery and all that. So,
by the way, we should mention, we're on your back porch in the neighborhoods near campus, and this is where you do your writing.
Yeah. And so I moved into this house last around Memorial Day last year, and one of the reasons I bought it was because the porch allows me to sit out for long periods of time and be outside in a way, and then write the book. And I wrote the book, honestly, in like 6 weeks. Sounds like I'm bragging, but I'm not. I had spent such a long period of time doing the research. There is a tremendous amount of published material, just all decentralized. And, you know, I have something close at one point, close to 300 different sources that I pulled from. I mean, the book is, I'm not a scholarly historian. I'm certainly not an archaeologist. I was able to sit down over a 6 week period and just basically write an overview of Native American history and archaeology within East Central Indiana.
How long would you say you spent researching this before, you know, you came to write?
Honestly, there was a project that I was developing almost 10 years ago now for students at Ball State. It was called Historic Muncie, where we did documentaries on the historic neighborhoods in the city of Muncie. And there are three or four county histories that I read, and I read them all in the summer before doing that project, just to make sure that I had really understood the history properly. And a lot of it talked about the Native period, and even 100 years ago, they knew that there was no Chief Muncie. The people that were building the earthworks were in no way directly connected to the Delaware, I mean, at least not that we know of, and separated by thousands of years.
Yeah, let's touch on that just a second, because if we want to see, and we're in your writing porch now, we'll hear the birds. If we want to see signs of Native Americans in East Central Indiana, you can go to Mound State Park, which is terrific. But those are the Adena Hopewell people who preceded the Lenape and other folks.
Yeah, so during the early and middle woodland periods, really the center of activity was south of Columbus along the Scioto River near Chillicothe. And there was an archaeological group of people called the Adena, or the archaeologists called the Adena. We have no idea what they called themselves. And they were later replaced by the Ohio Hopewell. And then there was an affiliated group or an offshoot, no one really knows for sure, that they refer to as Newcastle Fays, based off of a group of mounds that were found near Newcastle. And those are the folks that built, probably built, those mounds that built the stuff in Anderson. At one point, there were 10 different earthworks in Delaware County, and now there are three, and they've just been plowed over or development or whatever. So that stuff has still tucked away in people's farm fields and backyards and that kind of thing, but all coming from that one offshoot group.
Is it true, as you sometimes hear, that by the time the Europeans came here, the Adena Hopewell people who had sort of these Mississippian people who had built angel mounds down on the Ohio River, the mounds that we see at the Mound State Park in Anderson, they were basically gone by the time most of the Europeans arrived?
Yeah, so the Adena and the Ohio Hopewell, I mean, I think the Ohio Hopewell really are off the scene by 300, 400 in our common era, and then other groups replaced them. The only other mound-building group in this area was the Fort Ancient people, and they were mostly operating out of western Ohio. The big, huge mounds that are down in Paducah and Cahokia and then Evansville, those were built by the Mississippian people, and the mounds are used for very different purposes. So the Adena and the Hopewell were building mounds that were probably ceremonial or territorial. The mounds in that part of the United States, in the southern part of the United States, were part of village sites, you know. And even they were separated by as much as 1,000 years from the Adena and the Hopewell.
So when we see the mounds at Mound State Park, it's not that people live there so much as it was a ceremonial
site. That's right. So there's actually a whole sort of archaeological theory that the people would gather at the mounds for religious or cultural reasons, and then they would vacate for their daily life. And they lived near, but not really adjacent to them. And the mounds served in the way that we all go to church, you know, not all of us, but like the people in our culture would go to church, but we don't live on church property, you know, that kind of, it's a very loose analogy, but it's along those lines.
Chris Fluke, author of Native Americans of East Central Indiana. Coming up, we've been talking about the Lenape, and before them, the Adena Hopewell people who built the mounds outside Anderson at Mound State Park. But those mound builders were gone by the time European settlers arrived, so what happened to them?
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss on Indiana Public Radio.
There's lots of theories for this, but the best one was in a sort of proffered in a book called 1491. I think it was Charles Mann, I think is his name. That, for instance, when DeSoto goes through the southeast during the mid 1500s, he was illiterate, but he had a couple of people that could read and write. He kept very good journals, and they claimed to see thousands, tens of thousands of people, leaving the impression that the southeast all the way to the Mississippi is just teeming with Native Americans. By the time that the French come down the Mississippi 200 years later, it's empty. Few groups here and there. It's largely a depopulated area. And the idea is that the smallpox, the plague, the waves of disease spread all the way up through North America faster than the Europeans settled it. So people were dying in Canada hundreds of years before the first white dude ever stepped foot on the continent.
Because they traded among each other?
Yeah, they had an exchange network or a trade network, and along with, you know, start all the way from the Gulf, going all the way up to essentially Alaska. And, you know, it took years and years for that stuff to get up there, but it did. And along with that came the waves of disease.
Do we have in the journals or letters or things that survive, do we have people describing the Lenape and what they were like?
Yeah, so there was a group of Moravian, what we now call United Brethren, or what they now call themselves United Brethren, a group of Moravian missionaries that had for years had been embedded with the Delaware in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, and then asked the Delaware to set up a missionary site in what is now Anderson, and they reluctantly did so because there had been a lot of Lenape converts. And the Delaware here were interested in bringing all the Lenape people together. There was a group of Christian Moravians that had been massacred in Ohio by American militia. And after that, the Delaware were not friendly towards them. They blamed the Moravians, which is not the cause of it, but they blamed the Moravians for putting them in a position where they would get harmed. But in any event, two families of missionaries came here in Anderson about 1801, and then they left in 1806, and they kept extensive diaries. Very biased, mean. They kept calling that any Delaware that had not been converted, which was most of them, they referred to as heathens. I mean, I'm hesitant to say racist, but it's insensitive in every way. But it's a very good, even though they have a lot of misunderstandings, it's a very good overview of what life was like in the early 18th century, both along the White River, but certainly what was happening in the Delaware villages.
You can contrast the Lenape with the Shawnee, with Tecumseh and his brother, the Prophet. These were not necessarily allies.
Yeah, not naturally. And so we really don't know their makeup prior to European settlement. The Delaware at one point were called the grandfather tribe before European settlement because they were sort of the negotiator, like a Switzerland of sorts. People would just go to them because they always try to remain neutral and they would try to broker peaces between them. But then, you know, the Beaver War is when the French come and then the British, and it screws up the entire political arrangement. Generally, there was not a grand coalition between them until the Europeans came, and a lot of the Iroquois developed, sometimes white people that really don't understand, they might call them the Iroquois, but there was like, you know, 6-7 different groups among the Iroquois. There's the Algonquian language family, which is tons and tons and tons of languages. And they tend to be sort of formed a coalition a couple of different times as they were pushed with Pontiac's coalition, the Northwest Indian War, under the Miami, there was a coalition. And then Tecumseh, it was Shawnee, tried to form a coalition mostly among Algonquian speakers. And he tried with the Delaware. He was Shawnee, but tried with the Delaware, the Miami, and a bunch of other groups.
And there's a story of Chief Anderson saying no thanks.
Yeah, after, in fact, Tecumseh's revolution was really started by his brother, Layla Whitaker. And Layla Whitaker was this history, was overweight and had a history of drinking too much. And he started having all these visions. And at the time, the Delaware were undergoing their own sort of thing here on the White River. And a woman named Beta was also undergoing visions. And Tecumseh and his brother lived on the White River. They had a seasonal camp here. And so they were, both camps were sort of feeding off each other for this nativist movement. Beta disappears in the history. And then Layla Whitaker, the prophet, becomes a pretty central figure and leads this religious nativist revolution of sorts. They move over to Ohio, then they move over into near Lafayette, ultimately get defeated by Harrison. And then his brother comes back, who's in the South at the time, then it turns into a political movement that ultimately leads into the War of 1812. And Anderson really was Anderson and the Conners, but they really were responsible in keeping the Delaware neutral during Tecumseh's revolution in the War of 1812. Now, there were hotheads that, you know, young warriors that would leave and were like, screw this, we're gonna buck what the chiefs are telling us, and they would fight on both sides of every conflict. But yeah, the main body, their official stance was, we're staying out of this one, both in Tecumseh's revolution and in the War of 1812.
That's Chris Fluke, who teaches telecommunications at Ball State University, vice president of the Delaware County Historical Society, and author of Native Americans of East Central Indiana. A book signing scheduled for Saturday, July 9th from 8 a.m. to noon in the Orchard Shop at Minnetrista. You can buy the book there and at most local bookstores. His point, when it comes to history, as much in Indiana as anywhere else, we've tended to start the story with the settlers. It's as if there was nothing here but forests and deer when they arrived. The story, going back some 2,000 years to the mounds we see at Anderson, much deeper. And the Native Americans, whose people and places come down to us today in the names of our own places, like Delaware County, Muncie, Yorktown, and Anderson, truly worthy of a fresh look. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Sean Ashcraft, and all the folks in the front office, including your friends Matt Bloom, Connie Clary, Lori Georgie, Emily Kowalski, Andrea Lutz, John Morgan, Angie Rapp, and Debbie Webb. Glad you could join us this time. Hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Sean Ashcraft. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from IPR's listeners. We hope you'll join your friends who are IPR members. You can go to indianapublicradio.org or give us a call at 1-800-646-1812. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.